Flynn, welcome back to Think for Christ.
It's a joy to be here, Anthony. I was mentioning backstage in the VIP area that I've done a lot of interviews this past year with the release of my book, and the one I did with you is right at the top, so I was very excited for the opportunity to do this again. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate that you've carved out some time from your busy schedule, your busy life, to join me today. For those who may not be familiar with Pat, he's a real Renaissance man. He's an author, a philosopher, a PhD student, a musician, an entrepreneur, a fitness specialist. He hosts an excellent podcast. He regularly publishes on his Substack. And of course, most importantly, he's a husband and a father of what, six kids now?
Six children as of 6 weeks ago, yeah. Yeah.
Incredible. Did I leave anything out, Pat?
Man, you didn't know. This is making me blush, Anthony. Thank you. No, it's very, very, very good. Very good to be here. Very good to chat with you. Yeah.
It's amazing to me that you can find time to sleep or to bathe.
Yeah, well, bathing usually is what takes a back seat. So don't get a good thing we're on the internet here, not in person. And then the sleep is you'll take what you can get with six children. You know, you try to. My life is very monotonous. That's sort of if I have a secret that trying to stay productive, it's like I just do the same things every single day, including having a very early bedtime because I know it will almost certainly be interrupted at some point. Yeah.
Well, great. Well, last time you were on the show, Pat, we talked about your excellent book, The Best Argument for God, which was published last year, and I have it right here. For anyone who hasn't gotten it yet, please go to Amazon, get The Best Argument for God. I'll link the episode that we did before to the description of this video for anyone who wants to go back and listen to it. But today, I'd like to talk about a paper that you've written with, how do you say his name, Enric Gell, is that how you say his name?
Enric Gell, right, yeah. Enric really, Gell. Really smart philosopher over in Spain. Have actually teamed up with him for a few projects. But yeah, yes, people should check out his work. He actually hosts a very popular Spanish YouTube channel, but
really?
I don't speak Spanish. I don't understand a word of it, but he does great stuff.
The paper that you published with him is called The Malarian Cosmological Argument, Arguing to God Without the PSR. Has this paper actually been published yet, or is it still in queue?
It's forthcoming, so yeah, it's all through peer review, and but it's not out yet, as is the case with a lot of peer review. There's like a whole bunch of, there's a huge backlog of stuff, so the journal hasn't even given us an estimate when it will actually be out yet. But I will, for those who like this episode, I'll be sure to have the preprint up by the time you publish it, so people don't have to wait around forever to read it. Yeah.
Okay, great. And do you have a website where you'll put that, or?
You know what? I'll link it on my Substack. So
okay, great.
We'll make it easier. Yeah.
Well, in this paper, you guys formulate an argument for the existence of God that's based in the work of the philosopher Barry Miller. Mm-hmm. And this is an argument, if I remember correctly, that you actually presented kind of in an abbreviated form in your book. But it seems to me that this paper with Enric represents maybe a more rigorous formulation.
Yeah, that's right. So by way of background, I've always just, in general, Anthony, as I know you are, just been interested in different philosophical approaches to God, right? And there are some that I think are just interesting, but I'm not totally sure they work. Kind of feel that way about the ontological argument in a lot of ways, right? I keep coming, like, depends on the morning. Some mornings, yeah. Like, oh, yeah, this is the best thing ever. Other days, I'm like, oh, this is silliness, right? Obviously, I'm a big fan of a lot of traditional cosmological argumentation, and we spoke about that last time. Mm-hmm. And the way that usually works is you come up with some sort of explanatory or causal principle that ranges over enough stuff that it pretty much only leaves you with God as the conclusion, yeah. Right? That's it in a nutshell. But I've, in one sense, it's a great difficulty. In another sense, I think it's no difficulty at all, is justifying those explanatory or causal principles. And what I mean by that is, like, on the one hand, they seem like the most obvious thing in the world, right? Like, that the principle of sufficient reason is true, that things just, whatever exists and that is inherently causable has some sort of cause, right? It isn't just there for no reason whatsoever. Like, that seems almost like the most obvious thing in the world. But at the same time, there's a lot of clever puzzles and objections to those principles that takes a lot of real work to deal with those. And I think they can be dealt with, and I spend a good amount of time in my book dealing with them and justifying those principles. But I was always interested in not because I necessarily felt that it was necessary, but just to see if there was another avenue, if there was a sort of cosmologic argument where you didn't need something like the principle of sufficient reason. Because I always thought, well, that would remove a huge obstacle, right, to cosmological reasoning.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a number of atheists, I don't know if there's a lot, but some really smart ones, including some well-known ones, that essentially, you know, put the principle of sufficient reason and God together, right? My friend Jim Madden studied with Bill Rowe, and Bill Rowe would tell him, he's like, yeah, if you think the PSR is true, you should be a theist. I just don't think that it's true. So, like, with that sort of thing in mind, I always thought, well, it'd be kind of nice, kind of cool, kind of interesting if there was a way to God that wasn't a priori.
If I could just stop you right there, is just such an incredible statement that Rowe makes right there, especially when you put it in historical context, because to say that if you have the principle of sufficient reason, it's just going to entail the existence of God. In historical context, I mean, 50, 60 years ago, maybe 70 years ago, we weren't even talking about arguments for the existence of God, right? Yeah. I mean, this was, we were under the darkness of logical positivism in in philosophy departments. And so I just want to stop you right there and say that for Rowe to say something like that, in my mind, that is a huge, massive, earth-shaking concession from a historical perspective, because we've come all the way from logical positivism that held reign pretty much for the entirety of the 20th century to the point now where these really intuitive, strong principles are being admitted by really prominent atheists to entail the existence of God. I just have to stop you there and say, yeah, it's challenged today. There's challenges to some of these fundamental principles, but man, have we come a long way. And I don't know why it just struck me when you quoted Rowe there.
Yeah, I think so. Look, it struck me too when I first heard it. I was like, really, Jim? And I totally believe Jim. And he studied, you know, he was at Purdue and stuff like that. And he's got nothing but great things to say about Bill Rowe, even though he was, you know, obviously put out a lot of work against theism.
Yeah.
But it's cool to hear things like that, you know, from smart people. Because, like, to me, it's like the PSR seems as obvious as anything. And, you know, Rowe had his objections, and I deal with some of those in my book and stuff like that. And right. So even though I'm not, like, super concerned about the truth of PSR, I was still just interested, you know, like, hey, what kind of paths can we take, right? And there's paths from you know, like possible cause paths. So I was just exploring around in the literature and seeing what there was. And eventually I got to the work of somebody I put off for a while, you know, Anthony, of Father Barry Miller. And I put him off for a while because a lot of people that I respect and admire spoke extremely highly of Miller's work. But for whatever reason, I just didn't get to it right away. But as soon as I did, I was pulled in like a tractor beam. It just struck me that this man is a genius, a very quirky genius, extremely peculiar, unforgiving, often confusing in his style and terminology, but he could just see the world metaphysically. You know, some people just have that ability, right? They just like cut through all the fog, and it's like, here's the structure of reality. Let me lay it out for you, right? And he, throughout his entire career, actually did lots of work on the contingency argument in really creative ways. And just to give a little background of Miller, I know you wanted to talk about this anyways. He was, he got his PhD from the Angelicum, but then insisted on then going and studying it at Cambridge. And while he was at Cambridge, he actually took 2 months to go to Oxford, where he was tutored by Anscombe. So he's really one of these people that is definitely in that sort of analytic Thomist tradition. Right. Right? He's got training in traditional Thomism, but most of his work was in analytic philosophy, right? So he's an analytic philosopher, but he's bringing in, you know, a whole lot of perennial philosophy to his work. So he's to me, he's kind of able to make the best of both of these worlds, a great synthesizer. And so he's doing work on the contingency argument throughout his career. And in the 90s, he kind of, you know, has his master work on it called From Existence to God. And this book is like impossible to find. So I hate to like get people too excited, but like unless you use like your interlibrary loan system where you're willing to pay an outrageous amount on like eBay or something, you're just not going to get your hands on this thing.
No, so I've been able to find it.
Yeah, no, it's so hard to find, but it is worth finding. So I used I got it from Marquette, and it came in, and I held on to it forever, and I actually, photocopied all of it, so I've got it. And I studied it, and I was just so amazed again at the depth of this man's brilliance. I think it is one of the, if not the best contemporary books on the existence of God, certainly one that nobody's ever heard of. And he's developing an argument to God completely without the principle of sufficient reason, where he ultimately claims that if you hold a certain ontology, a constituent ontology, we can talk about all of these steps in a minute. Either everyday familiar objects like me, you, Thumper the rabbit is the example I use in my paper, a pet rabbit, are caused to exist throughout the entirety of the existence, have the sort of unity of their constituents is funded, or they are internally contradictory structures. And as contradictory structures, they can't exist even as brute facts, right? So you can't brute fact over these things, right? He
That's
says
right.
this question is logically inescapable of their existence, right? And if you want to avoid or alleviate the contradictory implications that come out from just considering these beings in se, just in and of themselves, right? You have to make reference to an extrinsic cause. So the first time I encountered his argument, I was like super confused, but mesmerized by it, because unlike my paper, he's not presenting it in my way. He actually kind of angles in through philosophy of language. He develops his own
Logic,
on
no.
yeah, log philosophy of language, is using that as a sort of he thinks language is a mirror of ontology, for example, which is controversial, but he defends that pretty seriously. I didn't want to have to do that in my papers. So we can talk about those differences and move along, but
Sure.
he spells out a constituent ontology from philosophy of language, and then he sort of launches his argument from there. So it's technical, it's long, it's a dense book, it's unforgiving. He expects you to be like ready to have like the deep conversation right away. He doesn't do any hand holding, which I think is part of the reason he's been overlooked. And sometimes people who are that brilliant just have this issue, right? Like they just don't, it's a problem of knowledge. Like they don't even realize how brilliant they are, even among other brilliant people, that to get and appreciate somebody like Miller, you have to invest in him. And let's be honest, there's just so much out there that I just don't think people were willing to make that investment. So he's
And
kind
he's
of been
innovative.
gone.
He's innovated. He's introducing new ideas, and sometimes these new ideas take time to catch on. So I hope that some of the ideas that he unpacks in his work get more airtime as we move forward here. But your paper inspired me to go back and actually reread Miller's wonderful book, A Most Unlikely God, which
Brilliant, isn't it?
I couldn't find it either, so I had to get the PFD,
The
PDF and
PDF.
like print it out. I like wasted 100 pages of paper to get my own book version of A Most Unlikely God. But in reading this, I was freshly reminded of Miller's genius. So if we have time, we'll see if we have time. I'd like to talk to you about some of his other novel ideas in this book in particular, Most Unlikely God.
Yeah, I'd love to. And people can find the PDF of that. So you can find that one online.
Yes,
And
you can
then
find that online.
his third book, I think these would be considered a trilogy. You can still order that from Amazon. That's called The Fullness of Being. And that one is brilliant as well, because this is where he defends a thick theory of existence. He defends the coherence of subsistent existence, and it's sort of an extension of that prior project, ultimately defending the doctrine of divine simplicity. I think he's one of the greatest defenders of that doctrine in the contemporary
I
age.
agree. I agree. All right. Well, very good. I'm gonna give you the floor here, Pat, so you can walk us through the Millerian cosmological argument. Maybe as a prelude, you've mentioned the PSR. I've mentioned the PSR. Maybe you can just quickly give us just a quick rundown of what we mean by the PSR, and then use that as a running start.
Yeah, let me do a good amount of stage setting, because honestly, I think the argument goes like fairly quick once you have the pieces in place. There's objections, and some are kind of, in the weeds, and I cover those in my paper, but I don't think the thrust of it is too hard to grasp if you have the right background. So I think it's worth spending a little time on that. So the principle of sufficient reason essentially states that whatever exists has some sort of adequate reason. for why it exists and has the characteristics that it does. Adequate reason doesn't mean that it's a determining cause, just that there is something that removes the mystery of why this thing exists at all, exists in the way that it does, so on and so forth. So I have claimed, and I'd be curious your thoughts on this, Anthony, that the PSR is implicit in most traditional forms of cosmological reasoning, including Thomas Aquinas. And it's funny, one of the reviews of my paper that I had to address was very upset with that claim. He's like, Thomas doesn't commit himself to the sorry, whenever I have to do the voice of reviewer too, it's always Thomas doesn't commit himself to the PSR. This is nonsense. This is nonsense. I'm like, of course he does, right? I mean, he literally has it in the De Ente, right? That I forget his precise formulation, but it's, you know, anything is accounted for either by the principles of its own nature or an extrinsic agent. That's the PSR, that's right. Dude. That's PSR. So I wouldn't even say he's implicitly. I would say he's explicitly committed to PSR. He just doesn't call it PSR, right?
It's yeah, he says if you're going to explain the existence of something, if you're going to explain it, it has to be explained either by the principles of a thing's own nature or by an external cause. So it seems that he is looking for an explanation. He's working with an explanatory principle here, and he gives us two of them.
Totally, totally. So I thought that was objection was just nonsense. I get it. Like, some people just think that PSR is like just Leibniz's version, right? Which is too strong. But obviously, if you've kept up with the contemporary literature, that's not PSR these days. That's a form of it, but it's a form that I haven't seen a survey, but I imagine most philosophers of whole PSR don't endorse that particular form these days, right? So, right, what does that mean? Well, it means that Aquinas himself, and I think, you know, trace back as far as you want, is committed to the complete intelligibility of reality. So PSR and brute facts are like enemies, right? If you hold to the PSR, you're essentially saying that there are no brute facts. And a brute fact is something that doesn't seem relevantly different from all the other sorts of things that have some sort of adequate, you know, reason for their existence. But just doesn't. It's just there. And Bertrand Russell famously said this at the universe, right? It's just there and that's all. So just stop asking questions. You're not going to get an answer, right? So a brute fact is not a mysterious fact. A mysterious fact is we don't see what the cause or explanation of this thing is, but we still assume that it's there somewhere. Maybe we're not smart enough. Maybe we'll never find out what it is, but we still assume that there's some sort of explanation to be had. Brute fact is much stronger. People who hold to a brute fact say no. There just is nothing to account for this particular concrete state of affairs or concrete being or what have you. And the idea here is that if you reject PSR and you hold to some brute fact or collection of brute facts, you are essentially denying that reality is completely intrinsically intelligible, right? That there are some questions that can be coherently asked that cannot be coherently answered, right? Somewhere in reality, right? Whereas if you're on, I would say, the side of perennial philosophy, you don't think that that's true. You think reality is completely intelligible. You think that there is a correct answer to every coherent question that can be asked, even if we will never have, maybe only God has those answers, right? But we believe that those answers are there, right? Available to somebody, maybe even just God, right? And like, to me, this is a really big and significant position. I don't think it's just a minor thing of where you fall on either side of that debate. I'm of the impression that if you don't take the side of perennial philosophy, I think that reality kind of winds up being fundamentally absurd. I think I don't think that you can have like a mostly intelligible reality, park it in some set of brute facts, and hold on to the intelligibility that you think that you had, right?
I agree.
I think that there's this sort of brute fact explosion, right? That like once you get the brute facts, you had all this sort of borrowed or derived intelligibility that winds up in nonsense. And I think the nonsense goes back up. I think then the whole thing is nonsense or absurdity. Like what you thought you had with respect to intelligibility actually isn't so at all. And then I think you also wind up in... I'll give a quick illustration of this, right? Imagine that, like, super simple, right? Why is the Earth stable? Well, it's balancing on the back of a turtle. Okay. Well, why is that turtle stable? Well, it's on the back of another turtle. Why is that turtle stable? Well, it's on the back of another turtle. Why is that turtle stable? Well, it's on the back of another turtle. And why is that turtle stable? Well, it's just necessary. Well, why is that the case? Well, it's a brute fact, right? Okay. Have we really gotten it seemed like we were on, okay, we got kind of an answer. I'll go with it, right? It seems like we're kind of making sense of why the Earth is stable. But then when we get down to that thing that isn't relevantly different, right? And you could even leave the necessity claim out of it, but I throw that in there for people who are kind of hip to the contemporary discussion where you think just calling something necessary somehow solves issues, right? If anything, it makes it worse, because now we have a question of, well, why is this thing that isn't relevantly different from the other things necessary? Like, what? If anything, we've made the situation far worse. And then again, I think it just shoots back up, like the absurdity shoots back up. We realize, like, well, we haven't really explained anything. Like, we don't actually have like any intelligibility at all. Not everyone agrees with that. That's a provocative claim, but I think ultimately it's correct. I don't think that there's like some middle position here. I think that intelligibility has to go through all the way, or we're kind of stuck with a sort of not just an atheism, but an absurdism. Right? I think
that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And a catastrophic type of skepticism too. And in fact, many people who defend PSR, I know you've had a conversation with Rob Koons. He's one of the people in the literature on this, and people can check that out for more detail. But what they do is they often defend it dialectically along these lines of saying, hey, this is, PSR is actually sort of a first principle. Because it's a first principle, like, we can't get under it to defend it. Rather, we just have to kind of show like all the silliness and absurdity that comes from denying it. These sort of absurd, catastrophically skeptical scenarios. All right.
Yeah. All right. So it seems like it's a basic fundamental principle. But also, if you deny it, the cost is so high epistemologically. You're pretty much, to quote Alvin Plantinga, if you deny the PSR, and I'm convinced of this, you're pretty much epistemologically screwed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And there's all sorts of reasons for that, right? It's like if PSR is, just to summarize some that I know that your audience may have heard before, like if PSR is false, right, there's no way of assigning probabilities to uncaused events. Maybe a bean just, you know, pops out in front of me out of nothing, and that bean causes randomly a thought in my head of having the sort of sense impressions that I do that aren't caused by me being reliably connected to the external world. They're just completely random nonsense events, right? Okay, so there, and like, since I can't judge that scenario is unlikely, there goes a sort of reliability link that I need to have sense perceptions or empirical, anything related to the empirical realm count as knowledge. Even if it's true, yeah, it wouldn't count as knowledge, right? So yeah, that's right. I think those are serious threats.
So the PSR, the point here is that the PSR is very, very strong and eminently defensible. I know you believe that. Rob Koons believes that, referring to the episode that he was on. But so the point is the PSR is really powerful and defensible. However, we don't need it to argue for God. And that's kind of what you're doing in this paper, to say, hey, let's set the PSR aside, not because it's indefensible, but because, hey, look, okay, we can argue over the PSR, but we don't even need it. We can argue to God just using another principle that's a lot less controversial, which is the law of non-contradiction.
Yeah, less controversial, but not without controversy.
Yeah. This is philosophy, after all, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, philosophy would be like, well, you hold to this, and that's controversial. Dude, we're doing philosophy, man. What isn't controversial in philosophy, right? So just calling something controversial has never, like, struck me as, like, a good objection, right? So, yes, that's right. So, and not only that, Anthony, maybe we could get to this later. I actually think that if you take the path that I do, it actually gives you PSR kind of as a result on the back end of it, which is kind of cool. Because it's going to be the case that nothing contingent, right, could actually exist unless it is caused to exist. So it actually gives you a metaphysical grounding for the not just the truth, but the necessary truth of PSR. So I think that's kind of a neat bonus. I did not explore that in the paper, but I think that is an outcome. Okay, so let's get into the Millerian argument right now. So the things that people need to understand going into this is it requires a certain ontology, a certain framework of being, right? And that ontology is a constituent ontology. So what is a constituent ontology? Well, a constituent ontology is where you hold that everyday familiar things are made up of parts, and particularly some special kinds of parts, what we might call metaphysical parts or constituents. So I think we need to do a little bit of stage setting here, because this is an important aspect of the argument. It's not something I defend. It's something that I assume in my argument, but there's been a lot of good defenses of this sort of ontology recently. But we can get into it a little bit. So a constituent ontology would say something like this, right? That I, Pat Flynn, am a composite being that has certain parts that we have to affirm necessarily to make sense of certain aspects about me and the way the world is generally. So one of the big things that motivates constituent ontology is the problem of the one and the many, right? The problems of change or similarity and difference, right? How am I the same being that I was 5 minutes ago, 10 years ago, so on and so forth, right? And there's this general principle that if you're going to have legitimate change, something has to stay the same. And so this is where we quickly come to the idea of parts, right? You swap one part out and some other part stays the same, so we can have a sort of a unified center of activity or being, call that a substantial form, if we're following Aristotle, that goes through various contingent modifications by acquiring and losing certain accidental forms. So I have a substantial form, right? I am a human being, so I have the form of humanness, or whatever you want to call it, but I have certain accidental forms where my form is sort of being expressed in a particular restricted way at any given time. So here's a simple form, the form of sittingness, right? And I have that form acquired right now, but I can lose that form, lose that metaphysical part, and acquire a new metaphysical part by standing, get the form of standingness, right? So that's the idea. And if we're just following Aristotle, these forms actually relate to each other along the lines of a much deeper division of reality, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, the act potency division of being, right? So my substantial form sort of stands underneath as the reservoir of possible ways that a certain being could be expressed as a range of potentiality that is actualized by these accidental forms, right? That actualize my substantial form in either a sitting configuration or standing configuration or what have you, right? So the idea of getting towards a constituent ontology, again, is to deal with these sort of large-scale phenomena of reality, things like change, the problem of the one and the many. Take Fido the dog. Again, here's another example. How do we know that Fido that is barking is the same that Fido is the same as the Fido that is sitting? Again, we make appeal to these different constituents, these ontological constituents, right, of substance and attribute, at least at that particular level, right? Now, to contrast constituent ontology, one of the major competitors out there is relational ontology, and this would hold that things are essentially blob-like, they're intrinsically unstructured or simple, and they somehow sort of participate through through like a form of primitive exemplification in a realm of abstract, like very Platonic account, right? I won't try to adjudicate that debate here and now. There's a lot of literature on this. So I will say that at the outset, if you want to follow me in this argument, you're going to have to go the route of a constituent ontology, right? Now, I think there's decisive reasons to do that, and there's lots of really smart people out there who defend this, but I will say that's a sort of assumption of the argument going in.
And for some listeners, that may sound bizarre and foreign, but what you're describing here is just some of the basic tenets of classical philosophy. So yeah. We're talking Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Plotinus, Augustine, Aquinas, Anselm. So it may sound abstract if you're new to philosophy, but this is just basic stuff.
Yeah, and not only that, but like
the first couple millennia of philosophy.
I think it's obvious. I think it's demonstrable. And it's also not outdated. I mean, like so many people in contemporary metaphysics hold a constituent ontology, not necessarily Aristotle's, but I mean, you think of trope theorists and bundle theorists. Like these are people that think that everyday familiar objects have these special kind of parts, right? Because we don't just mean physical parts like cells, but like these special kind of constituents. The main difference is an Aristotelian or Thomistic theory is what we might call a substrate theory. So if you're like a traditional like bundle theorist, you think that things are made up of like a special compresence relation of properties. I think that's a problem. I think there's a binding problem there. I don't think like Socrates is Socrates because of certain collection of a wisdom trope and a sittingness trope or whatever. No, I think it's the other way around. I think that Socrates' wisdom gets its individuality from the substance that is Socrates. There's this underlying substrate that individuates properties, right? I think that's the right way to think about that. That's the classical way to think about it. Again, lots to go through here, but the point is that it's not like this isn't a theory that isn't taken seriously in contemporary times.
Right.
It's just that there's a number of different types of constituent ontologies out there, and I think the correct one is the traditional one of a substrate type of theory where you have an underlying substance, right, that serves to individuate and ground properties, attributes, accidental forms, stuff like that, right? Okay, so going further to what we really need to get to is Aquinas's constituent ontology in particular, because Aquinas has this rather famous, definitely controversial, if we want to use that word, right, constituent ontology of essence and existence. So Aquinas says that everyday familiar particulars like you and me and the bunny rabbit outside are most fundamentally composed of an essence element, a whatness element, and an existence element, an isness element, right? So, and these also relate as potency to act, right? That existence is the act of all acts. It's what sort of brings forth any particular finite being, brings them into reality, distinguishes them from nothing, and all the properties that they have, right? So, and Aquinas thinks that these things are really distinct. He gives all sorts of arguments for this real distinction thesis. Miller argues for this real distinction thesis, actually, again, just from philosophy of language. So he takes a unique, he argues that existence is a first level property attributable to concrete individuals. We can talk about that later if we want. Let me just keep setting the stage for now. So if you follow Aquinas and you hold to this constituent ontology, then I think it sets up like pretty quick for a cosmological argument. If you think that there are all sorts of things whose essence does not guarantee their existence, that need to have existence imparted to them, and you hold to the sort of causal or explanatory principle that he does, like, of course you're going to start looking for something that sort of sources existence to everything, that does itself not need to have existence sourced to it, right? And this is what famously gets Aquinas the result of tracing back or twisting up to a being whose essence just is its existence, pure to be, pure actuality, pure subsistent existence, right? And then he's got all sorts of cool ways of conceptually analyzing that to show that, this is God, right? It's got all the traditional divine attributes. Okay. All right. So where does the Miller argument come in for me? So what I wanted to do is I wanted to avoid Miller's reliance on philosophy of language, and I appealed to contemporary literature defending constituent ontology and Aquinas' ontology. And there's a lot of good stuff on this, and people can hunt down the footnotes in my paper if they want to investigate that. And actually make Miller's argument a little bit more Thomistic, right? Run it specifically from the Thomistic ontology rather than his ontology of property instances. Now, I actually think that these are pretty much the same thing, but Miller doesn't admit as such, aside from like an obscure footnote here or there of saying like, you might think this is like Aristotle's ontology or something like that. So I wanted to specifically avoid Miller's road in, take a contemporary road in from a lot of the great work done defending this particular ontology, and then run it from the Thomistic ontology in particular. So I'm not just giving or defending Miller's argument. I'm actually trying to represent it and resituate it in a way that hopefully will give it a bit broader of an appeal. if that makes sense. Yeah, I haven't gotten to it. Is that good by stage setting, by the way? Sorry, that's great by stage setting.
Yes. I would just remind any listeners that I did do a whole episode dedicated to the Thomistic cosmological argument on Think for Christ. So this is confusing. Go back, reference that. We talk about Aquinas and the distinction between essence and existence and how he derives an argument for the existence of God. So that could be a good source to go review some of these things that are part and parcel of classical philosophy. So
yeah, for sure. So I mean, just to motivate it a little bit, because I think it's worth talking, but like, you know, forms aren't automatically actual, right? Obviously, especially if you are a realist about forms and think that we have numerically distinct forms, right? So it totally makes sense to go for another principle beyond form to account for actuality, right? So that's one thing to keep in mind. Beyond that, if you follow Aquinas and you're an essence realist, a thing is more than its essence, right? A thing is its essence plus contingent and individuating features, right? But existence applies to the whole composite, the whole supposit, not just essence. So there's real non-overlap. Like existence extends beyond essence. So they're really distinct, right? For sure. Okay. So by the way, when I use essence, I'll use it broadly to sort of incorporate the contingent and individuating features so people aren't confused by that statement in my argument. All right. So now let's try and now step into Miller's shoes and talk about what he thinks the result of all this is without PSR. So this is a little bit technical, but I think only a little bit technical. So take, I use the example of Thumper the Rabbit, right? Not an imaginary character, not fictional, real everyday rabbit outside. In fact, he was a real rabbit at some point. My friend, I got to give him a shout out. My friend Gary Machuda had a pet bunny rabbit. He died, and this paper is dedicated to him. It was the cutest, very fat. He was a little overweight. I think that contributed to his premature. He had a massive seizure. He's dead, but we remember him fondly. So I want to thank Thumper for his contribution to this philosophical work. So Thumper the Rabbit is a metaphysical composite. Now, a composite, I take it as a conceptual truth that to be a composite means that you are and can be built up of these constituents, that the composite is metaphysically posterior or downstream of these constituents. That to me is just a conceptual truth of what we mean by a composite, right? Now, importantly, as I clarify in the paper, that doesn't mean that we have to go through a temporal construction process, right? I mean, you can run a thought experiment, like maybe there's this tower of Lego blocks that has just been there from all eternity, and nobody actually put it together, but it's clear it's still built up from those parts, and we can conceptually construct it, right? We can see that it has a sort of logical ordering to how the composite is made up or built up of those parts, right? Okay, so that's important to keep in mind, that a composite must be able to be built up from its parts, its constituents. All right, so if that's the case, and we're looking at the metaphysical composite that is Thumper the Rabbit, who has these two kind of fundamental constituents of essence and existence, we can start to ask, okay, well, how is this built up? And what is the constructional starting point? This is important, right? And this is, I think this is a key to the argument. Some things don't need to have a particular constructional starting point. If I'm doing a building a Lego tower, I can probably start with any number of blocks. Maybe I can't start with any block, but I could start with certain blocks, and it doesn't necessarily matter which block I start with. But other things definitely do have a logical constructional starting point. So this is where we get into the notion of logical priority, which I talk about in my article. And I argue that there is a clear, logical, necessary constructional starting point for the composite Thumper. But it's not what people might initially suspect. A lot of people might think, well, you have to start with the existence element, right? Because that's what supplies all the actuality and being. So clearly, if you're not starting with that, you have nothing to start with. And I'll say, that's a good thought. Hold on to that. But that's not quite right. You actually have to start logically with the essence element. Why? Well, because when we're talking about the existence of Thumper, there's that little preposition there, of, the existence of Thumper, where the existence element depends on Thumper for its what we might call completion or individuation. It's the existence of Thumper and not some other rabbit. It's not the existence of Velveteen or some other being. So it's logically dependent on Thumper to be a part of the whole. So there's a clear logical dependence in ordering here, where in order for the existence element to be a part of existing Thumper, the Thumper element has to be there first in order to make it the case that existence is individuated to the right sort of thing, right? Now this is I think inescapable, and I think that, and I'm actually working on this in a new article, but it's worth teasing here, where I think we should think about these types of constituents in atomistic ontology as something along the lines of incomplete entities, to use Fragean language, right? So it's important to understand that they're not nothing, they're not fictions, but they're not things in and of themselves either, right? We're not like totally reifying over them. Rather, they're incomplete entities insofar as they require completion or supplementation from their counterparts, right? To result in a complete or coherent whole. And existence is an incomplete entity with respect to individuation. It's not even meaningful without the individuation, right? So it doesn't even make sense to, like, if we're following like people like Peter Geech and stuff like that, to even just talk about existence in this context, unless it's with respect to what individuates it, right? Which means, again, there's a logical priority to the essence. This has to be the constructional starting point, right? We can't get Thumper built unless we're starting with the essence element, right? Existence can't come first. Okay. All right. So there's a consequence to this, a pretty significant one. And it goes back to what was just sort of hinted at before, is that considered apart from his existence, Thumper is nothing, right? He has no actuality, he has no presence, he has no properties, right? He can't, there's nothing to ground them. All right, so now, like, right away, we're already in like a pretty vicious metaphysical merry-go-round. So like right there, it's clear that we have a paradox and a problem, right? And that might be enough to just cause any reasonable person to say, okay, we gotta go to some extrinsic cause, because we can't just get this thing going just considered in se, right? But we can go further, and we can actually draw out a particular contradiction from here. And the contradiction is this, is that it's saying that, hey, as a composite, this thing must be able to be built up from parts. But when we run this conceptual analysis, we see that it cannot be built up from parts. So it must be built up from parts, yet it cannot be built up from parts. We can't begin with the Thumper element, because the Thumper element isn't even considered by itself the right sort of thing that can be a part of existing Thumper. So the existence element can't be a part of existing Thumper unless the essence element is, but the essence element can't be a part of existing Thumper because it's nothing, and it's nothing, it can't even have any properties, including the property of being able to be a part of existing Thumper, right? So I think that's right. I think when you really analyze this matter, you get this not just internal tension, but this contradictory result of something that must be built up of parts, yet cannot be built up of parts. Neither of these parts considered by themselves, and the whole won't do it either, because the whole is metaphysically posterior to the parts, can have the capacity that's required here, which is the capacity for Thumper to individuate his existence, right? So that's what we're looking for. We're not able to find it when we're looking at the composite whole or the parts. So what do we have to do? Miller says it's logically inescapable. We have to ground this capacity in some sort of prior actuality or some sort of prior cause that can supply the missing capacity. Thumper is still the bound or the sort of limiter range of this instance's existence, but he doesn't individuate his existence in virtue of himself. He does it in virtue of this extrinsic cause. And then he thinks once you do that, I think he's right, once you make reference to an extrinsic cause, the contradictory result is alleviated, but it comes with... the commitment that everything like Thumper the rabbit is either caused in its existence or it is an impossible existent. But it can't be an impossible existent because it's right there. He's stealing carrots, right? So he's caused. He's not just caused. He's deeply metaphysically dependent, right? Because there's no time throughout Thumper's existence where this problem isn't there, right? It has nothing to do with Thumper coming to exist, just like with the Lego tower block. We could imagine that he never had a beginning to his existence, right? This is an ongoing, for as long as Thumper is actually individuating his existence, this is an ongoing problem where you need to make reference to an extrinsic cause. Sorry, there's a lot there, and I hope at least a little bit of it made sense.
That was great. Yeah, that was great. So can we say that the essence element, the existence element, these are co-principles of Thumper's being?
Yeah, they contribute, right, to the whole of the composite, which is existing Thumper. That's right.
Yeah, because I think Aquinas
they each contribute something essential and necessary to the whole. That's right. Yeah.
Right. I think Aquinas would use the term principle to describe their co-principles. They both have to be there for Thumper to be there, and they have to be there together. So the contradiction comes in when you try to construct this being. If you're just thinking about Thumper existing all on his own in se, right, and you're just focusing on Thumper, the problem here is that both of these principles have to both be there at the same time in order to have Thumper. And if you try to prioritize one or the other to construct a Thumper, you run into contradictions because they both require the other. Is that pretty much?
That's it in a nutshell. And to term out principles, that is a good term because sometimes parts can be confusing. I like to use parts, but I think it's important to make the clarifications that we don't mean they have to be like literal Lego blocks, right?
It's
important that when we're talking about this constituent ontology, they're clearly not Lego blocks because they're incomplete entities that they can't exist separately, right?
That's right.
They're
distinct, distinct,
but not separable. That's right. So for Aquinas, you can have real distinction, but not real ontological separability, right? And this is an instance of that. But he thinks that form and matter are another instance of that and stuff as well, right? So that's an important thing. Sometimes that's a common misconception that people hold. They think it's fitting blocks together, or if things are really distinct, they must be separable. These are not. If you separate the essence and existence element, Thumper's gone. Right.
That's right.
So I guess they're separable in that sense, but then there's no more of any of it, right? They just poof.
Because you need the essence to individualize the existence, and you need the existence to actualize the essence, and without both of those principles, you have nothing.
That's correct. Right. Yeah.
And so what happens is, as you said, Thumper becomes a contradictory being in se. If we're just looking at Thumper all by himself, and we're not thinking about any external causes, all by himself, he's a contradictory being unless we say there's an external cause. Something brings these parts together.
That's right. Yeah, to put it in Miller's, like, talk about the ultimate pickup line, he'll tell you that there is no non-elliptical, non-contradictory construal of atomic sentences of the form A exists, right? Just put that, just like...
I'm going to use that at a party.
At some point. I'll use it on my wife because, yeah, that's what I had to do. Like, hey, babe, did you know, right? So he thinks that's right. So what does that mean? That, like, that sort of proposition, A exists, is a suppressed proposition or it's contradictory. Suppressed for what? Like, A exists qua dependent on... that thing is, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. All right, so I know in your paper you don't develop this, but the argument's not technically over because we have to rule out an infinite regress.
This is the biggest objection, actually. I think there's like two ways you can really come at this argument. One is you can attack the initial ontology. And I'm sort of lazy. I don't defend that. I think I think it can be defended very ably, right? I think it's a necessary commitment, a constituent ontology. But you could go there, right? You could just try and stab it right at the beginning, right? Or you could say something like this. Okay, you have demonstrated that Thumper the Rabbit and everything like him is the sort of thing that, if it's going to exist at all, requires a cause, right? But that doesn't mean that cause is God. For all we know, that thing itself has a cause, and then that cause has a cause, and so on and so forth. So there we go. We can alleviate the contradictory result with an infinite regress, and so we can make Miller happy and make the atheist happy at the same time, and everybody wins, and we can all go have a beer or a steak or something like that. So right,
go have some rabbit.
Yeah. So yeah, go have some rabbit. Go have some rabbit. And so first off, that wouldn't make Miller happy because he's got an article in mind where he shows that certain types of causal regresses are necessarily terminating or they're contradictory. And guess what kind of causal regress Miller thinks that this is, right? Spoiler alert, he thinks it's a sort of causal regress that is necessarily terminating or contradictory. And in one of my other, I think you should staple this paper to one of my other published papers, it was in Review of Metaphysics. And it doesn't seem initially related to cosmological reasoning, but actually that was the whole purpose of that paper, was to kind of get to this point. The paper is called Grounding Essentially Ordered Causation. That's a whole topic on its own. I'm just testing the hypothesis of whether contemporary theories of metaphysically grounding are what a lot of these scholastic dudes were calling essentially ordered causation, which is a certain type of a causal series that Aquinas appeals to that he thinks must have a primary cause. Okay. All right, where do I want to go with this? Well, here's where I don't want to go with it. I don't want to go, I think, Aquinas' route. Why? Because I think that even though he successfully argues that a causal series ordered per se, or essentially ordered, has a primary cause, I think he needs PSR to do it. You know what I mean? So like, it would be kind of a bummer if I had to bring PSR back into the argument to close off.
Yeah.
To close off the infinite regress objection, because then, like, at the end of the day, you still need PSR. So I don't want to do that, right? I want to drive this guy home all the way without PSR, right? And I think we can do that. I think we can actually do that pretty demonstrably. But we need the idea of metaphysical dependence or metaphysical grounding in hand, which I argue for in my review of metaphysics paper. So a deep dependence relation or a metaphysical grounding relation is where something isn't caused just diachronically across time, but synchronically. It's caused here and now throughout its entire, it's deeply dependent. That's a way of sort of thinking about what metaphysical dependence is up to. And for Aquinas, you know, in an essentially ordered series, if you have something like XYZ, that's the ordered series. When Y causes Z, it has to borrow the power from X to do so, right? Because it doesn't have that particular power or causal property in virtue of what it is. And that's why Aquinas thinks if you're going to get an explanation of a particular causal property like existence, you have to get back to something that does have it in virtue of what it is. Otherwise, you haven't got an adequate explanation, right? So that's why he thinks that if you have an ordered series of a whole bunch of things whose essence is really distinct from their existence, an infinite regress isn't going to work if they're all of that sort of thing, because now we've never actually accounted for how existence, if you will, got into the system to begin with, right? We need to get back to something that can account for it in virtue of what it is. But of course, that type of causal relation is deeply dependent. If something is caused in its existence, especially if Miller's argument is correct, it's either caused in its existence throughout the entirety of its existence, or it's a contradictory structure. That's metaphysical grounding. That is a deep dependence relation. All right. So next step is if we think that this deep dependence relation is at play between a composite and its extrinsic cause, like, it wouldn't be accurate to construe that causal series in a particular grammatical or logical form. So get a little bit technical, but go with me, right? So it wouldn't make sense to construe it as like A is caused by B and B is caused by C and C is caused by D and so on and so forth. That wouldn't capture the deep dependence relation. Rather, we need to say something like this, right? A is being caused by B only in as much as B is being caused to exist by C, only in as much as C is being caused to exist by D, so on and so forth. So the only in as much is the key there, because it signals a sort of reduplicative expression, which means that the particular grammatical or logical structure of the causal series of these sort of things is more accurately expressed along these lines. I'm going to read this from my paper because it's kind of a mouthful, but I think it captures the important part, right? So A is caused to exist by B only in as much as it is being caused to exist by C, only in as much as being caused to exist by D, only in as much as being caused to exist by D, and so on and so forth. But the thing about this type of grammatical or logical structure where deep dependence is in play is we cannot have a complete expression if that does not terminate. We don't have a complete expression. Now, why is that important to have a complete expression? Well, we think that the infinite regress is supposed to supply some sort of explanation, but you can't explain anything unless you say anything, and you can't say anything unless you have a complete or terminated expression, right? What's the connection here? Well, the connection is this. If we think that a causal series is supposed to give some sort of explanation, which it is, right? Causes are cited as explanations. It makes no sense to cite a cause unless you're intending to give a sort of explanation. And if this sort of ordered series, the way that the series is ordered grammatically and logically, can't say anything unless it's terminated. It can't explain anything unless it's terminated. Then it can't be a genuine causal series unless it's terminated. So either it's necessarily terminating or it's non-causal. That's the idea, right?
Nice.
I know that's a lot there, but it ends up giving you another contradiction where if you say that this is a causal series, which you have to say, but it doesn't terminate, then it's a causal series, it's non-causal. So we can ride the principle of contradiction.
Interesting.
All the way through. Start. There's a lot more there. That's a lot. I understand that. That's a hard thing to summarize. But the point is I think when you connect those two points, we can avoid PSR all the way through if we have a certain sort of causal relation at play, which is entailed by the Millerian approach to composite entities. Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Does Miller make that argument against an infinite regress, or is that your innovation?
It's a mix. So Miller, the best way to get the rudiments of it is from his article Mind. But again, Miller's just using an approach that's pretty different, and it's really complicated and technical. It's brilliant. But you'll find the kind of seeds of thought there. But then I bring in the more traditional scholastic idea of essentially ordered series, but also contemporary work in metaphysical grounding.
Yeah, the way you constructed the ordered series there reminded me kind of maybe something I've read from Gavin Kerr. But yeah, anyway, that's great. And that is in the paper that's in the other paper that you published.
Yeah, so if you want, and I think I reference it in the Miller paper, I forget, but that would be how I think to make sure, because it's one thing to think you can deal with the infinite regress, which I think you can with PSR, but remember the purpose of my
project trying to avoid it
is to avoid PSR through and through. So, oh, by the way, the final part there is it has to terminate in something, obviously, whose essence just is its existence, right?
Right.
Otherwise, you're just going to get the same contradictory result over and over. And then once you have that, well, then I guess you have the traditional, call it the gap problem or whatever. But I think that's handily overcome once you actually have Aquinas' ontology on hand, where you can run that.
So it terminates in the same place that the Dante of Aquinas terminates. It just gets there via a route that doesn't require the PSR. Now, you say in your paper that there's two primary objections to arguments that deploy the PSR. There's the brute fact objection, which we've already kind of dispensed with, because now we can see that without an external cause, Thumper the Rabbit is a logically contradictory being. Mm-hmm. So that kind of dispenses with the brute fact retort. But the other one you say is the fallacy of composition is another objection to arguments deploying the PSR. So how does your approach avoid the fallacy of composition?
Yeah, good. So, just because each of the individual pieces have a cause, that doesn't necessarily mean that the whole has a cause. Now, that is an objection that is raised against other forms of cosmological reasoning. Think like Leibnizian forms, right, where we deploy some sort of aggregation strategy, right? We kind of smush together all the contingent facts, and we want a cause of the plurality, right? So this is where people will object along the lines of composition fallacy or what have you. I think there are good responses to that. Again, I think that objection can be overcome, and I work on it in my book. But the neat thing about the Millerian argument, you don't have to aggregate Jack. Man, you just start from Thumper the Rabbit. That's it. You have one being, and it drives you straight through. So you don't have to smush things together. There's no concerns about trying to figure out whether the universe is some huge object in and of itself, or it's a mere aggregate. Like, it just avoids all those worries entirely. You just need one thing situated in that constituent ontology, and you're good to go. So I think that's another benefit, right? Because that's a pretty consistent objection that can be pretty tricky to work through. So I think whenever you can avoid those, just avoid those types of things entirely, that's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Okay, so given the presuppositions that you presuppose in this paper, a thick theory of existence, constituent ontology, so forth.
Yeah.
I was trying to think if there was an objection in the neighborhood that I could formulate, taking those presuppositions on hand and then formulating some kind of objection, even if given these suppositions, can I still object some way to this argument? And I couldn't think of an objection, because it just seems to me that your conclusion is entailed. Mm-hmm. But let me ask you, is there an existential inertia objection lingering here? Or I was trying to think of an objection that used the premises of existential inertia,
yeah,
but it just seems like existential inertia is just ruled out.
I think this is another upshot of the argument. I think it clearly sucks all the room out of any possibility for existential inertia. Why? Because of everything in fact, one could just see this as a long argument against existential inertia, right?
Right.
Because considered in, say, Thumper, the Thumper element, the essence element, without having already completed his existence, which is contrary to it being the logical starting point and really distinct from existence, is incapable of being that starting point. And this is the problem. This is a problem, as I emphasized before, throughout the entirety of his existence. It has nothing to do. In fact, talk about Miller being ahead of the game. He emphasizes this himself in his own book. He really hammers this point home, saying this has nothing to do with generation or whatever. This is a problem always and everywhere for any composite being for as long as it exists. So even though I didn't intend this argument to be a response to existential inertia, like, I honestly think you could have just made that the title, an argument against existential inertia, and it would function just as well.
Yeah.
That, right.
Mm-hmm. And those, I don't know, maybe I'm naive and too dumb philosophically, but I'm not impressed by the existential inertial arguments against, especially arguments that are from, you know, the traditional philosophical metaphysical approach, because it seems to me that approach itself is an argument against existential inertia. Like, if you take it in hand, then you can't have existential inertia. So it just seems to me that criticisms of arguments like this one, from you just throwing existential inertia at an argument like yours, is just out of bounds.
I think that's right. I think as a sort of alternative thesis, as a different sort of metaphysical proposal, fair and interesting, right? That's a wider debate. But I think once you have enough of the traditional existential Thomistic commitments online and a proper understanding of the relationship between essence and existence and form and matter and substance and attribute, I'm not moved by it either. And I'm talking about in the traditional sense, but certainly I think if you have Miller's argument in hand, you have these contradictory implications. That's all the stronger reason to reject that thesis, if you will.
Right? I agree. Mm-hmm. And existential inertia itself has to be nested in some kind of a grander story, right? Some kind of a wider worldview. We have to give some kind of a philosophical account of exactly what that is and how that works. And at that point, then we're just doing worldview comparison.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying. Like, if you're having a wider metaphysical debate, why should you know? Here's why you should prefer this particular account, which, you know, can accommodate existential inertia over, you know, Thomas's or Plotinus's or something like that. Yeah, it's all fair game. But that's different than thinking that existential inertia is actually doing work as an objection once you're already, like, so far down a particular metaphysical road.
That's right.
Right.
That's mm-hmm. right. Yeah. Very good. Very good. All right. Let me just finally ask you here, what have been the responses to this paper? I know it's you're directing this paper particularly at people who accept these presuppositions, and Thomists in particular, it seems to me, especially Thomists who utilize the de ente argument from Aquinas. So have you, I know it hasn't been published yet, but I'm sure you've kind of shopped it around. Have you had responses?
Yeah. So it hasn't been published yet, so I'm sure there will be more discussion and engagement once it gets out. I already kind of indicated one from reviewer two, but that wasn't towards the argument itself, right? That was towards my claim, which I think is just obviously true, that Aquinas himself held to PSR, and it would be nice that if we didn't have that commitment, or if we didn't need that commitment to run a cosmological argument to God. Let me think here for a minute, because as is always the case, Anthony, you know, like, you finish a project, you ship it off, and then it's like, it's been months and months since I've even looked at this thing, right? So, like, I'm trying to, like, make sure I'm not forgetting anything important. People sometimes don't understand how slow the publishing process is, start to finish. Like, I've since moved on to thinking about many other different things.
Yeah.
I did try to incorporate some of the objections to Miller's original argument that he didn't particularly address in my paper, but I don't know if those would be worthwhile talking about now. People can just read the preprint. There is, I will, I think the wider project again is just on kind of both ends, right? Defending that, like, if I was playing devil's advocate, what would I do if I was really trying to break this argument and escape it? I would go for the initial ontological commitments, right? And that's why I wanted to step away from Miller's controversial, there's that word again, right, use of philosophy of language, right? And show, because to me that just gives another route into the argument, and having different paths in is an advantage. So, like, if you're into philosophy of language, if you think language is a mirror of ontology, even if you think it's a dusty mirror, which I think is right, actually, great. I mean, you can argue that subject and predicate really stand for object and property instance, and like you can spell out your constituent ontology that way and run the argument. And I wanted to say, no, we can establish this ontology through all the cool work that's being done in explanatory and descriptive metaphysics, that as a theory, it resolves a host of issues that have been, like, perennial philosophical, like the one in the many, how to make sense of modes of being, avoiding skepticism. So I kind of, like, make those appeals in my paper of just saying, like, as a theory, this thing is, like, super jacked, right? And there's not really any, like, great objections against it, or any objections that seem formidable. Like, Miller, I think, quite decisively dispatched them in his other work, particularly Fullness of Being. So once you have those commitments in place, then I think it's just coherence on the back end, right? What is this subsistent existence thing? And that, of course, is where his work, Most Unlikely God, is just absolutely brilliant. And there's so much there we could, I would love to have another conversation on it at some point, because I think it is just a defense of divine simplicity. That, like, everybody who's having that debate right now, you need to go and get caught up on that, right?
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. I mean, he's so ahead of the game on like modal collapse objections, contingent knowledge objections, just God is the limit case instance of certain things. It's like, man, yeah. Like, how did people miss this book? Because, like, I read so much of the contemporary literature. I'm like, oh, yeah, Miller dealt with that. Miller dealt with that. And, like, nobody's citing him, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if his notion of a limit case is intelligible, which I think it is, I think the examples he gives are perfectly coherent, then I think his arguments go through. So, you know, but I don't want to start a whole nother episode here. We've already gone more than an hour. So we'll have to have you back, Pat, if you're willing to come back, and maybe we can talk about A Most Unlikely God and
always really for you, brother. Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And really drill down on his Miller's innovations in terms of divine simplicity and talking about limit case versus limit simpliciter, mm-hmm. and God as the zero bound instance of existence.
Right,
that's another phrase you can drop at your next holiday party.
Yeah, gonna be real popular around Christmas time this year, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, but as far as this argument goes, anything else that you think is pertinent or you want to say about this, or are you comfortable with?
No, the rest is details. Here? You know, there's important details as always, but that's why you rewrite the stuffy academic papers to cover the details. I think we got the general thrust out of it, at least hopefully enough to get people interested, not just in my paper, but really my mission, Anthony, is like to get people interested in Barry Miller. He's the real genius. And I think it's just a great shame that his incredible amount of work has just been so overlooked. So if nothing else, if this just gets people, you know, going back and bringing him back into the conversation, I'd be really happy about that.
Well, it's certainly done that for me. I mean, I read A Most Unlikely God. I was familiar with Miller. That's really the only work that I've interacted with his. I'm going to go back and start reading his other stuff if I can find it.
Yeah, so, it's tough.
Yeah, so I appreciated Miller, but I don't know that I really understood him. And then, you know, interacting with your Substack and stuff, I'm like, you know what? I need to go back and reread it. And the second read was really fruitful. I mean, really fruitful.
Yeah, that's such a good thing to say, because I was the same way. Like, first time I read him, I'm like, what is this guy going on about here? But, like, I just trusted that, like, the people who told me he was brilliant was right. I stuck with it. And then finally, like, you know, things started to click and I had those aha moments. You know, another guy like that is Bernard Lonergan. Like, the first time I tried to read Insight, I'm like, what is this? But, like, people tell me this guy's brilliant. He figured a whole bunch of stuff out. So, it just, dumb old Pat stuck with it. And eventually, I was like, yeah, all right, this guy is brilliant. And, like, him and Lonergan, and, like, so many else, like Aquinas, too. Like, you never fully grasp Virginia. You keep going back to him again and again, and you just, and every time you do, you just get something awesome and new out of it. Miller's one of those guys for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for reintroducing me to Miller. I really appreciate that. It's just been such a boon to my own thinking, and so many insights from him. So I think, Pat, that'll do it for now. Before we sign off here, let me just let the listeners know that there are several ways to interact with Pat's work. Of course, you can order his book, The Best Argument from God, or I'm sorry, The Best Argument for God. I'll put the link for that book in the description of this video. You can also follow Pat on YouTube at his channel, Philosophy for the People, and you can subscribe to his Substack, which is called The Journal of Absolute Truth.
Humbly I love that name.
I love that title. So links to both will be in the description to this video. So thanks again for coming on, Pat. It's always a great time.
Thank you, Anthony. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.